Welcome to DeltaCast, everybody, the podcast about the science of learning and development. My name is Eric Jackson. I'm here with co-host Mark Blumberg. Hey, Mark.
Hello.
And our special guest for today's show, Vanessa Labou. It's great to have you here, Vanessa.
Thanks.
Mark, yes. You once pointed out how you noticed that people who are scientists, people doing research, in a lot of cases choose what they're studying based on personal experience. So you're a self-proclaimed horrible sleeper, right?
Yes, and bad at temperature regulation, too.
And bad at temperature.
Both things that I've studied. But I'm not sure if you choose it or if you just gravitate towards it. It's sort of one of these things that people, I think some people have noticed. I don't know if it's a rule per se, which leads to an interesting question, Vanessa. Do you study fear because you have some issues about fear?
I don't think so, but I did start studying this because my mentor, Judy DeLoach, was terrified of snakes. Mm. So that...
Snakes. It's always snakes.
It's always snakes. And she was terrified of snakes. In fact, I always knew when a stimulus was a good one, when I would show her and she wouldn't be able to look at it. She would, you know, jump back from the computer screen. So she was terrified. She still is terrified of snakes. So that might be where
that's a great thing to
started.
Have on your advisor.
Yeah. She's so, Judy DeLoach, terrified of snakes.
So when you noticed this in Judy, did you say, oh, that's an interesting question? Is that how it evolved? I mean, that you actually just noticed this thing and it raised the question, or you were already thinking about fear?
Well, it evolved in a conversation with her about it. So she was really the person who was interested in fear of snakes. And I think part of it was because she was so afraid of snakes that she wanted to believe that there was some evolutionary origin, so sort of an excuse for why she was so afraid of snakes. So that's really conversations with Judy about the fact that she was so afraid of snakes and noticing that it's always snakes. Lots of people are afraid of snakes. That's what made me start going into this research. It's a very different topic from what she was studying in her lab at the time. So it was quite a departure from studying symbolic development.
So what was the first, like, how did you tackle it initially? What was your first thought about how to go about asking this question and addressing it?
Well, it was an
easy... What was the question?
Well, so...
And what do you study?
So I study the development of fear, anxiety, and avoidance responses in general, particularly avoidance responses towards things that adults tend to think are threatening or scary.
I have a fear right now that... We're going to be talking a lot about stuttering on this podcast today.
We're not.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There was an easy place to start because I started reading about fears of things like snakes and spiders, and there's a lot of theory about it, but there's not a lot of research on children. There's not a lot of research on development. So the predominant theory about fears of snakes and spiders is that it's part of this evolved fear module that we have inherited from our ancient ancestors. And so I think that the reason there's no developmental research on it is because the idea is that there isn't development. So, you know, we're born with this fear module and learning to be afraid of snakes and spiders either happens really early or it doesn't have to happen at all, according to some researchers. So it may have been by design that there was no developmental work because, I mean,
why bother?
Why bother? Something evolved. Why do you need to study development? So I was really curious about, you know, what babies and children would do when confronted with something like a snake or a spider. So that's how it started. It was an easy place to start because there was nothing really on what babies and children did with snakes and spiders. I mean, who would think to put a baby with a live snake?
Yeah.
Except for us, I
would,
I guess.
I would, but I don't have children.
Who would think...
Well, we did.
Who would think that there is some innate fear module?
Who?
Well, there's lots of people, actually. So... Evolutionary theories of fear acquisition are very common, or of at least, so we can take it down a notch and just say avoidance behavior. So avoidance behavior is one of the behaviors that's associated with the fear response. So we can be more general and say avoidance of things that are like, that can bite you, like a snake that can hurt you. Things like snakes and spiders, things like heights, things like, contagion, like disease. There's lots of different theories that suggest that we should have these evolved mechanisms that facilitate avoidance of these types of things. I was on the phone with someone from the Discovery Channel. I was just telling Mark this week, and I had to convince him that he showed me this video on YouTube of this baby sitting in a zoo. His parents like have him up against the tiger cage. And he's like 8 months old. He's just sitting there. He can't move. And this tiger is pacing behind him, opening its jaws exactly the size of this kid's head and trying to eat the kid. And the parents are like laughing because, I mean, it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But the kid is not reacting at all. And so, like, not reacting fearfully at all. The kid doesn't care. And what they were asking me is, how is this possible? How is the kid not reacting? Shouldn't we have some fear mechanisms that protect us from predators? And I actually had to convince him that, like, well, I mean, why would an eight-month-old baby be afraid of a tiger? An eight-month-old baby doesn't know what a tiger is.
There needs to be some kind of association that's made between the tiger and something bad, right? That
right.
will give the baby the impression that, you know, oh, shit, yeah. I got to get away from this tiger because
yeah.
it's right. about to eat me, right?
Right, and I mean, and theoretically...
It seems like common sense, right?
Yeah, and does an eight-month-old even know what a threat is? I mean, does an eight-month-old know, that understand that things can eat him? I guess it's probably not.
Right.
But there are different kinds of theories of fear acquisition, and one is the general learning theory that you're touching on now, which is there has to be some either association via classical conditioning, or there has to be some vicarious learning or social learning. So you have to watch your mom act fearfully toward a tiger, or there has to be some transmission of verbal information. So you have to hear someone say, oh, did you know when that tiger is opening its mouth like that, it's trying to eat your head? So, you know, the general...
Because having fear at that moment would prevent the tiger from closing its jaws around your head.
Exactly. Yeah. So even if the baby was afraid, what would it actually
do? I want to be clear about the adaptive outcome of this particular fear for the child,
which is
basically like what kind of taste will he be providing to the lion?
That's a more fearful one, I guess. fear tastes
a little bit
like
of urine.
More whammy.
So where do you fall on this? What's your
I fall in the middle. So on the okay. so that's the general learning paradigm, which suggests that all fears are learned with the same degree of ease. They're all learned the same way, and there's nothing special about snakes, and there's nothing special about water bottles, and there's nothing special about stuttering. There's nothing special about anything. Then you go the other way, the totally like nativist innate perspective, which researchers in this domain call themselves non-associativists. So they don't think that you need associative learning in order to have fear of certain kinds of things, including snakes and spiders and heights.
It's so just magically born with it. There.
Yep, you're born
it's
with
magic.
It.
It's magic.
Yep,
okay.
And you have to the what is learned is actually you have to learn to not be afraid through habituation or something like that. So that's what gets learned. You have to unlearn the fear because you don't need to learn it. So that's the sort of theory.
Well, that could be studied by looking at like herpetologists. I mean, I know people who study snakes who have children who study snakes. And I guess you could actually look at the development of fear learning in those. I mean, do they actually have to unlearn some innate? I mean, it just doesn't make sense, right? I imagine what happens with kids who are born into herpetology families is that they just are always around snakes and they never associate them with anything bad.
Well, this is the problem. There are a lot of easy ways to look at this developmentally.
Yeah.
It's just that researchers mostly haven't done it. One, because, I mean, to be fair, do you really want to put a baby with a live snake? Probably not. I mean, I did it, and I'll tell you about that, and it wasn't so bad. But
well,
I think a lot of researchers
don't leave us hanging. How did that
let's talk about that.
No, yeah. I did a study. I wanted to see what a child will do with a live snake and what their reactions are. What I did was very simple. So I put 18 to 36-month-olds in a room with a bunch of fun toys and with four live animals. One was like in a little cage in each corner of the room. And one of them was a snake. One of them was a live snake moving around. One of them was a tarantula, live tarantula. One of them was... See, this is what I mean. I mean, people, yeah. like you propose this to your IRB and they're like, you are crazy. The other one was a betta fish, you know, a pretty fish. And the fourth one was a hamster, a fuzzy, you know, cute thing. And so all we did was put the kid in the room and let them do whatever they wanted for 5 minutes. And then after 5 minutes, we let the parent interact with the kid. And we measured all sorts of things. So how much time they spent with each toy, each animal, whether they asked questions about each thing, whether they talked to them, you know, stuff like that. And what we found is, first of all, that there were no differences in any behaviors that the kids had toward the snake and spider versus the hamster and the fish.
How old were these kids?
18 months to three. So a year and a half to three.
Okay.
So some of them were more verbal than others. But the striking thing that we found is that they just really liked the animals. So they spent like twice as much time with the animals that they couldn't actually interact with, right? So they were in terrariums. They couldn't touch these things. And in fact, most of them, I mean, the snake was kind of active, but like the hamster was kind of asleep and the tarantula doesn't really move. So they're not like dogs and cats. They're not as interesting as those animals that walk around and interact with you. And they just spent most of their time interacting with these animals. They really liked the animals and they really liked the snake and the tarantula just as much as they liked the hamster.
Any preferences at all?
Nope. Just the only huge effect was more time with animals versus toys. And we had pre-screened these toys in a previous study, and we picked the four most interesting toys that they liked from another study, and they still just wanted – I mean, they played with the toys, but they just paid way more attention to the animals.
So what do the people who take a more nativist view – like what would they say about a result – like that, you know, because clearly that is demonstrating that
they're not afraid. I could make a few predictions. One is that, you know, a lot of the evolutionary folks take a more middle of the road view. So they do see that there's a role for learning. They call it prepared learning, and they just suggest that learning fear for snakes and spiders just happens faster. So I think that they would probably say that they haven't learned yet, and if there was an opportunity, they would learn really fast. I think the non-associative folks would say that they've already unlearned it some way. There's always an explanation. And to be fair, you know, as a scientist, you always have an explanation for something. You can always come up with an explanation. So that's my guess is what their explanation for this.
Well, you can't do this experiment, I suppose, because ethical problems. But if the kid stuck his or her hand into the aquarium with the hamster, and the hamster bit it on the finger, pretty sure that kid's not going to have a very good attitude about hamsters.
I also think I had hamsters. Hamsters are mean and they bite a lot. So my guess is that they're probably more likely to be bitten by a hamster in their lifetime than a snake.
Yeah.
So I think that...
And hamsters are not natural predators of humans.
And not evolutionary threats of humans, theoretically.
They might nibble at your ankle a little bit.
Or your toe. They're really small mouths.
Would... One way to test this, though, be just to get, like, infants who are just born in there and stick snakes around and hamsters around and
Well, we tried to do something like that, around. Too. So we didn't look at newborns because that's really hard to – newborn is like – I've had one. They're like blobs. They don't do anything. Right. But we did look at nine-month-olds, and we didn't want to let a nine – like, so my instinct about nine-month-olds is they're going to grab everything that's in front of them. And so an IRB is not going to let you put a snake in front of them. Not because,
a harmless snake, you can't – I mean
– Oh, it's not for the protection of the child. It's for the protection of the snake. Mm.
So
getting the IRB approval to do the study I just told you about was crazy, not because we wanted to present children with a tarantula and a snake, because – we wanted to present a tarantula and a snake with children. So they were very concerned about the well-being of the tarantula and the snake. And they should have been. We had to attach these terrariums to the wall because these kids put their faces on them and like tap on them and they try to lift them up. So I understand why people are concerned more for the well-being of the animals than the well-being of the children.
I should say for the non-academic listeners that IRBs are the institutional review boards that actually determine what work can go forward at a university and whether they oversee the ethics of the research.
Yeah, so we had to write a proposal and get them to approve whether or not we can do this study, and all of their concerns had to do with the well-being of the animals and not so much with the well-being of the children.
Well, counterintuitive, I have to say. I mean,
yeah, but they were right on. I mean, they made us attach these things to the wall, and they made us take these precautions, and they were right, because these kids, a lot of them tried to lift the cages up and tap on them.
And the kids are way bigger than these animals.
These animals are not that big. Yeah. And a tarantula is actually quite fragile. So you don't want like a 3-year-old shaking a tarantula's terrarium. So we did do a study with younger babies, 9-month-olds, but again, you can't present a 9-month-old with a snake for the well-being of the snake. My guess is a 9-month-old would just grab it. But what's nice about 9-month-olds is that they're not that bright, and 9-month-olds don't really understand the differences between a 2D object and a 3D object. So they can see that a 2D object's different from a 3D object, but they don't know what the properties of a photograph or a television screen are. So they explore it, and they treat it as if it's a, like things on a television or on a book are like real things. So they might try to pick up something from a book that's a 2D object. They'll like rub it, and they might try to pick it up. So what I did is I showed 9-month-olds moving snakes and other animals on a screen and put them right up to the screen to see if they would try to pick up snakes from a screen. And they do. They try to, you know, they get their hand right on there and they try to pick it up. They try to pick up other animals too. But the point is, they're not avoiding the snakes. They are trying to pick them up from the screen.
Isn't it the case, Vanessa? I mean, that you present, you can do all this research for the rest of your life, and you could accumulate all kinds of evidence. But people who are committed to these ideas that are really not testable, a lot of these ideas that the evolutionary psychology types really, you know, glom onto, they're not going to change their mind. There's no piece of evidence. You can always come up with an alternative hypothesis that's going to protect their preferred way of thinking about it. So let those people do what they're going to do. So my question is, what has surprised you the most? What, like, of all the things that you've been studying in all the years you've been doing this research, what has surprised you the most of what you found?
What surprised me the most is, you know, one of the things that I study is detection of these things. So theoretically, this evolved fear module should be activated automatically in the presence of some important threat to humans, like snakes. So one of the things that I spent a lot of time studying is detection of snakes in a visual display. And
I'm not super familiar with this literature, but the terms that I hear a lot are fear and threat, and sometimes anxiety. Like, what's the
difference?
Yeah.
So fear.
And what are like the overlapping characteristics between the? How are they related?
Well, that's a
such?
Big question. So okay. People don't agree on what.
Skip that one then.
No. I'll gloss over it.
Okay.
So people really fight about what fear is and what fear looks like in the brain, and what behaviors sort of identify fear. People don't even agree on what an emotion is. So I would say that fear, let's just say we all agree that fear is an emotion. Fear is a very specific emotional response to some elicitor, something in the environment that, you know, you notice and you have a fear reaction. Anxiety is more like a mood. So people have described it as either a state, so you're in a state of anxiety, or it's a trait. So some people are just more anxious than others. And being in an anxious state or having anxiety as a trait makes you more prone to experience fear. So that's how anxiety differs from fear. So fear is sort of an immediate reaction to something specific, whereas anxiety can be looming and it doesn't have to have a specific cause or a specific object. Like, fear is about something immediately in your environment. Threat is tricky. So threat is something that in the literature is used to describe things that might have compromised a human's survival. So and an evolutionary threat is something that, you know, was a recurrent and widespread danger while humans were evolving. Now, of course, you can say, how do we know what was a threat to humans during, and we can't. So it's a very difficult thing. I think it's a really problematic claim to make, because you can't, you know, we don't know what was an everyday threat to our earliest human ancestors. But that's the way the term is used in the literature. I think that you can also argue that snakes actually do hurt people and they are capable of hurting people. And most, at least from what I've seen in my lab, and we have some data on this, most adults would say that snakes are threatening. So you could take either perspective. So you can say, well, I'm just using it as a term that these psychologists use to describe a certain set of stimuli. Or you can say, you know, now, I mean, it is something that can actually cause harm and does cause harm to humans. Spiders, you know, I don't know how harmful you could really say that spiders are to humans these days, but snakes still do kill people.
I saw snakes on a plane, and I think that a lot of people were, in fact, killed
on that plane. Yeah, a lot of people were killed.
Because the snake... Wait. Explain that? What?
There was a movie called Snakes on a Plane.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that one.
You're probably lucky.
You're lucky.
Like, what's interesting here is that threat, right? So it seems like a way that a lot of this stuff is tested is, okay, we're going to present people or infants with high valence stimuli, right? Or like,
that's
threatful.
The same problem, though. So valence is the same issue.
Yeah.
Whereas, so I would argue that for a baby, snakes have no valence.
Whoa. Which is exactly what I was getting to.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you know what's a high valence and what's a low valence, especially when you're doing work with infants?
Well, so let's just use the terms that are used theoretically. So these are things that... supposedly posed a threat to human beings. So, and according to the theory,
from an evolutionary standpoint, which like may have nothing to do with that infant. I mean, maybe,
no,
maybe. Depending on your, yeah.
But if these theories are correct, perhaps. So the theory is that these animals do have valence for babies. And what I have found is that I haven't seen evidence that snakes and spiders carry a negative valence for babies.
They do carry the positive because they're attracted to these animals.
They are attracted to all animals, it seems like. But I've seen no evidence that they carry a negative valence.
When negative valence starts to emerge, at what age does it start to emerge?
Well, there's some research suggesting that animal fears start to emerge around 6 or 7 through the age of 9. They kind of...
Years?
Yeah, 6 or 7 years.
Wow, that's a long time, it seems.
Yeah.
It's a long incubation period.
Yeah, so so according to the clinical literature, and a colleague of mine, Andy Field, who's at the University of Sussex, he's a clinician and he does a lot of work with fear of animals, and he's looked at animal fears. And between 6 and 9 is when you see lots of animal fears with kids.
And what is happening in the natural life experience of a child that's 6 to 9 years is the...
That's causing that.
Do they start to show fears to other sorts of things that are non-animal fears, or is it just to the animal fears itself?
Well, themselves? So that's... Animal fears are some of the first ones that you see very commonly. They're also fears of like...
Yeah, what are the other fears that kids have?
You know, it's not widely studied. It's not a huge field. And that's why when you asked me how did I get into it, it was pretty easy because there's not a whole lot of literature on how fear develops. And I think part of it is because we've made some assumptions about normative childhood fears that when you actually look at development don't pan out. Another one is heights. You know, I think that in the literature, developmental psychologists have believed for a very long time that fear of heights develops as children learn to crawl and walk for the first time, to crawl for the first time. This is work by Joe Campos, where babies who are learning to crawl will start avoiding a visual cliff, which is an illusory drop-off. And the explanation for this avoidance behavior is that they have learned fear of heights through self-produced locomotion.
It seems like what would be more reasonable is proprioception and a body telling you where you are in space as opposed to actually just the ability to crawl or to walk, no?
Well,
it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, so I think what the Campos folks have said is that before self-produced locomotion, babies could perceive heights, but it really isn't meaningful for their bodies until they start moving around on their own. So, and sort of, I guess the the proposed mechanism that drives the avoidance behavior is fear of heights. But other work from Karen Adolph's lab suggests that it's really not the case. That's not why they're avoiding the drop-off. And one line of evidence for this is that when they start to walk, they have to relearn what heights are safe and what heights are dangerous. And if the mechanism causing you to avoid is fear, that fear of heights should translate to the new posture. But avoidance behavior doesn't translate to the new posture. So what it really seems like they are learning is just what their bodies can and can't do for a certain posture. So when they're crawling, they learn what kinds of drop-offs are safe to descend and which ones are not safe once they have lots of experience.
So that's really interesting. So it raises some interesting questions about whether or not you could do that kind of a study in fear, right? So context matters. How you move about your world matters. And maybe it's as simple as whether or not the animal is behind glass or not. But it would be interesting to know whether or not a child who learns fears in a particular context would not generalize that fear to a very different context. Maybe be fearful in the home, but not in the zoo and vice versa. You know, that sort of thing. And whether, how specific that stuff. Do you have any ideas about that?
Well, there is research on fear of strangers that sort of speaks to this. So fear of strangers is another one of these things that's supposed to develop normatively in the first year of life. And it's supposed to be, you know, people have assigned an adaptive value to being afraid of strangers. And if you actually look at the data, and a lot of this data was produced in the 60s and 70s, what you see is an actual much more, it's a more nuanced response to strangers that is highly dependent on context. So there are some babies, there is a proportion of babies who react negatively to strangers no matter what, no matter what the context is. And Kristen Buss at Penn State has called these babies dysregulated. And what that means is that they're unable to regulate their response based on contextual information. So if they're in the lab, if they're in a high chair, if their mom's there, if their mom's gone, anything novel is bad. But what most babies do, the majority of babies do, is their responses really vary based on context. So studies that look at stranger approach, meaning, you know, usually a male stranger approaching a baby, you see almost no stranger fear if it's at home with mom there. If it's in the lab where the babies are in a high chair and mom's not there,
it's
a weird environment. You see the most negative responses. And Michael Lewis did this amazing study. I don't know how he did it, but he basically varied. I'll just say what he did. He had three different kinds of strangers approach babies. One was another child, so short stature, you know, and looks like a child. He had a midget approach them, so short stature, looks like an adult, and then an adult male approach them, tall, looks like an adult, and he, you know, what you see is what you would expect, a graded response based on who the stranger is. So
how old?
So stranger fear is said to start around 8 months, 8-9 months, peaks like a little bit after that, 12 months, and then starts to wane at 18 to 24 months. So it follows this sort of developmental trajectory. But what you see is that it really depends on context. And to me, this is just a much more interesting and nuanced phenomenon than just babies are afraid of strangers. What they're really doing is taking context into account and responding based on the amount of novelty that is present. And if it's like a lot of novelty, if it's super weird and the stranger's touching you and your mom's not there, yeah, that sucks.
Get off me, man. What are you doing?
Like, I would cry too. I don't want strangers touching me either. I don't blame them.
Issue of how people study things that are personally relevant. I'm a person who stutters. I study stuttering and speech production.
Are you going to ask me if strangers have touched me? It's not. They haven't. Don't worry.
Okay. Good. I feel relief.
Okay.
A big part of stuttering is the response to those interruptions in speech,
which is probably anxiety. Sometimes.
So here's the question, right? Or here's the statement that I'd like to hear your thoughts on.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the cognitive response to getting stuck. It could be a variety of different things. It could be, you know, like, oh shit, I'm about to get stuck. So then the avoidance response comes in. I mean, avoidance is a huge component of stuttering.
And I'll
you
tell
know you- that you're going to stutter, and then you will do whatever you can. And a lot of people who stutter spend, you know, most of their time trying to figure out ways not to stutter, right? So this cognitive response changes the behavior, right? So clearly a developmental disorder that changes over time. What's your take on, like, how something like emotion or fear, you know, which is like a primal sort of response, I think, is what you would say based on what I've heard so far. How does that impact the cognitive response? And then in turn, what's the cognitive impact on the emotional?
That's a good question. So first of all, avoidance responses are really common of fears and anxieties. So I'm not a clinician, but from what I've read, I mean, most cognitive behavioral therapies are really focused on eliminating avoidance behaviors when it comes to phobias and fears.
Which is the same in stuttering,
yeah.
Right? So there's something called desensitization,
mm-hmm.
Right?
It's the same thing for fear.
It's the same thing.
This goes back to theories of what an emotion is and what an emotion does. And so, you know, really traditional theories of what an emotion is and what fear is that it's sort of this discrete category. Like, fear is a thing that's represented in the brain with some dedicated circuitry. And fear causes different behaviors. So the fact that you're afraid causes you to avoid, and it causes your heart to race. It's like this sort of classic question, right? Does your heart race because you're afraid, or are you afraid because your heart races? So it's sort of essential to what an emotion is. So it really depends on what you think and what your theoretical perspective is. So some folks think that fear causes avoidance behaviors. It causes cognitions. It causes physiological responses. And these are, you know, these theories are probably still the most dominant in the literature. Like, discrete emotions theory is the classic emotions theory. There are some more recent theories who sort of flip it around, and they suggest that emotions are sort of this multi-component, emergent, thing that emotions emerge out of a cluster of behavior. So in other words, fear is, you know, comes out of the fact that your heart's racing and you want to avoid this thing, and you have all of these behavior, and you might have detected this thing really quickly, and fear emerges based on the interpretation of all of these behaviors plus context.
So let me ask you then, so is fear or any emotion, is it a category label that we use to describe this collection of things that they under which it fits, or is what's important about fear or any emotion the feeling that's associated with it? Where do you, I mean, we, you know, people study fear in animals all the time. You can't study their feelings. You can only look at what they do and how
right.
they respond. Where do you fall on that particular?
So thing? I fall on more of the multi-component or emergent perspective, where I think that, and most people think that emotions have associated physiological responses, feelings, so the experience. There are certain behaviors that go along with it, and there are cognitions that go along with it. So the question is, do you think fear causes these things, or are these things that, you know, that you're experiencing, is fear the category you assign to them? And this latter view is the one that I'm more in favor of. And Lisa Feldman Barrett really believes that language and categories are really important in experiencing discrete emotions. So, you know, fear is this category that we have, and it's the category we assign to this cluster of physiological responses, behaviors, feelings, cognitions.
So that, I have to ask now. It's my turn to have to ask something. So there, you could get this discordant relationship between, how the behaviors and the physiological responses of a child and how and what they're feeling or how they're and other aspects of the behavior. I mean, you could actually, we see this in all kinds of things in development where you get different pieces, you know, ultimately in adults, a lot of things seem to coalesce and become one system. But they tend to be more discordant when we're younger. So might you see, like Karen Adolf, you talked about the fear of heights, these kids are on these ledges or whatever, and they're laughing. Or they might show a physical response in one dimension that someone might indicate, someone might think is a sign of fear, but exhibit on their face a complete lack of fear. So do you see these sorts of discordant responses in your kids?
So I think that the Campos camp would come from that perspective where, you know, children's emotional responses are discordant and the behaviors that represent an emotion don't correlate very highly when children are young. Although there is evidence that they don't really correlate higher when we're old, correlate highly when we're old either. So, I think it's problematic. So we have to think about what children are capable of. So the reason why things are discordant is because children have capabilities that are not equal to those of adults when they're little. But one thing that we know for sure is that a fear response, for example, involves negative affect. So a negative feeling.
You're talking about a facial response.
Well, no, not necessarily, because I don't think that they have to show a fear face, in order to feel negative affect.
So you're talking about like some kind of a reaction where you're moving away from a stimulus or something like that?
I just think that if they're feeling real fear, they should at least show something negative. So I don't think that they need to show a discrete fear face that has the wide open eyes and the mouth and the eyebrows. But, you know, newborns can experience positive versus negative affect. They react positively when something is good, and they react negatively when they don't like something.
Yeah, but the positive and negative, that's kind of like a
it's very
researcher
general.
Decision.
The best evidence is that you put sugar in a kid's mouth and they exhibit this licking response, but you put something sour in it. And this is true in rats and humans and other animals. They all show it, all of them, newborns. And you stick something that's sour and they show like a sticking out of the tongue, like they're rejecting it. So it's something that's for a system that's that, you know, well prescribed, you can actually define, you would call one of them positive and one of them negative.
It's like almost taking it in. Or like the decision to
reject.
Yeah,
so everything else is like a, can, you know, what other systems show that something that's that clear, I guess, is one of the questions. Like, is there anything as clear as what happens with the ingestion response?
I think that maybe not with a newborn, but certainly, well, maybe not with a brand new baby, but a two and a half month old can smile. I mean, they're perfectly capable of showing positive affect, and they're capable of showing negative affect by crying, vocalizations. They don't necessarily, I think there's very little evidence that a newborn or even a 3-month-old shows evidence of discrete negative emotions, meaning you can't really differentiate sadness from fear, from anger in a 3-month-old, but you can certainly differentiate positive versus negative. And they can do that, just like you're saying, very early on. So the fact that on the visual cliff, you know, presented with a drop-off, they're not showing any signs of negative affect, to me, is problematic. So I don't think that you need to have a discrete fear face, but they're showing no signs of negative affect. So I think just avoidance alone is, it's very hard to make a claim that they're afraid of heights, because we avoid things all the time that we're not afraid of. I avoided stepping in 3 puddles today. Does that mean I'm afraid of puddles? I think you'd be hard pressed to make the argument that just because I avoided the puddle, I'm afraid. So here's the problem with babies. One of my favorite things that Lisa Feldman Barrett said is, if you want to know if somebody's experiencing an emotion, you have to ask them. So you can ask a baby, like, do you feel afraid? But you're not going to get a very good answer. So we have to interpret their behavior. And, you know, because emotions are so complicated and people disagree on what they are so intensely, I think you need multiple converging measures. You need more evidence than just avoidance, especially when avoidance is something that could be associated with a lot of things. So if you had avoidance and you had, I think that if you're going to suggest that a baby is experiencing some negative emotion, you need some sign of negative affect at minimum. Like you need, you don't need a fear face. You don't need something that specific, but you need some kind of negative vocalization, some kind of negative affect on the face. Again, it doesn't have to have all of the components of a fear face, but with fear of, with heights, again, we don't see any of that.
Just going on the fact that it's, oh, there has to be something we can observe on the face. I mean, again, that's going towards the adult interpretation of like what is an avoidance or what's a fear. Because crying, that could be a positive thing. I mean, a baby can enjoy crying,
but
right?
You can turn that argument around and say that interpreting something as fear because of avoidance is also an adult interpretation. The baby's avoiding because they're afraid, because when I'm afraid, I avoid. So that's why I'm suggesting that we need a lot of different measures. If we're going to conclude that a baby is experiencing fear, we need a lot of different measures.
And of course, I mean, at some level, this discussion of emotion, and I've never been a big fan of emotion talk because I'm a closed adult male who has trouble finding his feelings.
Who's in the higher circuits here?
But in the end, evolution doesn't see emotion. In the end, evolution sees behaviors. Either you respond in a way that's adaptive and it leads to your survival, or leads to some kind of a response from your parent, from your caregiver. You know, if you do that, fine, then you're better off. And if you don't do those things, but the feeling is irrelevant to the adaptive nature.
Okay,
it's more likely to be like the steam rising from an engine than it is to actually be the engine itself that's driving the behavior.
But here's the problem with heights.
But I'm hardcore about that.
Here's the problem with heights, though. So the visual cliff research is kind of weird because the visual cliff is weird. So the visual cliff is like this cliff, this drop off. So it has a shallow side that looks like a floor, and then there's a piece of glass that covers this drop off that looks like there's a 90 centimeter drop to the floor. So babies explore it. They just don't know what to do with it. It's kind of weird. They've never experienced anything like it before. So we spoke about Karen Adolf before. She what she did was practically take the glass. She took the glass off the visual cliff and did a real cliff. And what we find is that they don't actually avoid the cliff. So we don't even have avoidance here. So we don't have anything. So they don't like walk down the cliff. They know that they can't step down a 90 centimeter drop off, but they try to find another way to get down. And so I've seen in her lab, I was a postdoc in her lab, which is why I'm talking about her so much. I've seen babies just hanging from this 90 centimeter cliff. If you're afraid of heights, which I'll admit I'm a little bit afraid of heights, I'm not going to climb a cliff and then hang on, you know, try to get down and hang on my arms from the drop off. Like, that's not avoidance.
So
behavior.
What you need to do is you need to combine these two approaches and put snakes on the cliff with the baby and see what they do there.
Well, I think that's
double down on the fear.
Well, that's
factor.
What snakes on a plane did. Fear of planes. Fear of snakes.
You're on a big cliff.
But
it's a great.
But just going back to what you said, though, Mark, it can't be all about the behavior, though, right? Because that was the sense that I. Just because at some point the cognitive is going to influence the behavior.
If you're a dualist,
and it's interesting when that.
If you're a dualist.
I don't even know what that means.
I choose not to separate these things off. We are one organism, mm-hmm. and we have one brain, and it's all functioning towards one thing. So
completely. But what I'm saying though is that. So yeah. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't.
If it makes you feel better, I won't use the two terms. Right.
Thank you.
However, you can become aware, and then because of your awareness, you can choose, regardless of how conscious of a decision it is, you can choose not to do something. So that will directly influence what the behavior is. So to say something like it all comes down to what the behavior is.
Well, I still think ultimately it's the behavior, whether you inhibit a response or you produce the response.
But
in a research
matters.
Sense, though, it's much more difficult to test, you know, when you're choosing not to do something as opposed to when you're just doing it. And I don't think that that's appreciated.
My point is simpler. My point is really just about that, and this whole discussion about emotions and what, you know, whatever. In the end, how you feel about something is not as important as what you do, what you behave.
Yeah, but
how
the
you behave
is
going to
influence that, though.
Maybe. How do you know that?
Right.
Prove it.
It could, though, is all I'm saying.
I'm just saying that this is the
But you're not going to see
the problem
with
psychology.
But, But you're not going to see the behavior, though, because of decisions that are going to be made based on...
If I don't see the behavior, then the lion's not going to see the behavior, and the snake's not going to see the behavior, and the kid's going to end up dead no matter what. So, I mean, not to be too crass about it, but in the end, you better, if you're going to be all animals face this, and all animals, all these animals out there that are doing what they're doing, we're learning a lot about them without knowing anything, and we'll never know anything about their feelings. And so ultimately, you know, one of the tricks of doing human research, this is just my personal opinion, I'm just editorializing, but one of the tricks is to try to treat human beings as animals. And this becomes a really big problem with babies where they can't give you language, they can't tell you stuff, and so you're interpreting things with the mind of a human towards a kid who's a member of your own species.
The mind of a human adult.
A mind of a human adult at all, and there's so many problems of interpretation, over-interpretation, insertion of your own ideas into the mind of a baby. Yeah. And in the end, this kid is just trying to figure out how the hell the world works.
And this is the whole issue you already brought up with what is a threat, because we're talking about snakes and spiders and strangers as threats, but like to a 3-month-old baby, none of these things are threats. They don't know what they are. They have no meaning. They have no valence. So, you know, I think that... you're absolutely right that part of the problem with fear research, over decades, developmental fear research, is we've inserted our own human adult perspective on what babies should be feeling when they avoid the visual cliff. Because, you know, heights are scary and they should be afraid of heights. So, you know, they're avoiding, so they must be afraid. And it's very striking if you look at some of the papers written about this in the 60s and the 70s, the assumption going into these papers wasn't, the research question wasn't, will babies be afraid of heights? It's that we know that babies will be afraid of heights. Let's look at the developmental trajectory, or let's look at this. The assumption is that heights and strangers are things that scare babies. So... you know, and so the assumption going in is that they would be afraid. So the interpretation of like a sober expression, for example, just a serious face, a change in facial expression, is interpreted as fear. And it comes from a very adult-centric perspective on what babies should be feeling. So I think that I think that this is right on, that, you know, this is the problem with terms like threat, and this is, you know, why we've made a lot of assumptions about what babies are afraid of for years and years, because we base it on what we think that they should be afraid of.
Is fear different in infants than it is in adults?
Well, I mean, that's a really hard question to answer.
Okay.
I don't know.
So let's move on.
There's debate about whether babies even feel fear, and no one actually argues that they do before like 8-9 months, and they argue that strangers are the thing that they're afraid of first. But it's just, again, we're interpreting their behavior, and it's really hard to interpret. So who knows if it's experienced the same, if it's fear at all. I mean, there is evidence that some small proportion of babies do show behavioral responses consistent with fear when strangers approach them. But I mean, who knows if they experience it the same way that adults do? It's really hard. My guess is, I mean, adult fears are more complicated because, like you said, cognition becomes quite involved. And, you know, if you asked me if I was afraid of snakes, I wouldn't know what to tell you, because context matters so much to fear, I think, to most normative fears. To phobias is different. Context doesn't matter.
To most behaviors, right?
Ever since we've been talking about, you know, fear and having, you know, talking earlier, so I go back to this experience that I had. You know, I was a 12-year-old kid. I went to the movie theater. I saw this movie called Jaws, which a lot of people think of perhaps today as, yeah, it's a minor movie at the time.
It's a B movie.
Very little B movie. And
it really doesn't need any.
It scared the living shit out of me. I mean, that movie created it created havoc in my life, and to the point where I now, even as an adult, if I'm bobbing in the water in a freshwater lake, all I'm thinking about is my legs could be disappeared any moment by an underwater sea monster called a shark. But, you know, as I was telling you earlier, you know, I'm a scuba diver, and I had managed to do a whole bunch of scuba dives without ever encountering a shark. Now, I had spent my whole life fearing nothing but sharks. I knew it had something to do with going off the beach, you know, because that's the first scene in the movie, you know, mm-hmm. when the girl goes out there and she gets the bottom half of her just eaten initially. But I had this decades-long fear absolute fear of sharks. Until, you know, well, maybe not until, but then I'm scuba diving and I'm down about 50 feet underwater in the, wherever I was in the Caribbean. And I turn around, I'm like holding onto a rope that's descended from the boat. And I turn around and lo and behold, there's a 12 foot nurse shark that's coming my way. And it's like 15 feet, 10 feet, whatever, you know, with those eyes and those teeth and those whatever. And, I mean, it was a big monster shark. I did not bat an eye. I watched it. I was fascinated by it. I didn't feel any, like my heart didn't skip a beat. I had no response. Decades and decades of fear about sharks, the images of them, the thinking of them, thinking about being eaten. And one of my favorite things is like, you know, how embarrassing it would be to be eaten by a shark. You know, it's like, that's it like the most embarrassing way to die, I think. Maybe being pummeled by squirrels would be worse. But,
dying during sex isn't an embarrassing.
that's bad too. Okay. Well, actually, but not quite as bad. Kind of cool. Okay. But being eaten by a shark and I didn't feel anything. I felt nothing. How could that be? How does that fit with any idea about sharks? It doesn't, right?
No. Nope.
But it's true. That's my own personal experience. I had no response. I was up. I was like, I saw a shark, but there was no, like, oh, my God.
By the way, I just read that if you get attacked by a shark, it's a myth that you should punch it in the nose.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's one of my dreamed, you know, responses.
Yeah,
to
that
a
you
shark.
Shouldn't do that because chances are you'll miss and like your hand will go at its mouth. You should try to poke out its eyes.
Poke out its eyes.
And its gills. Go for the eyes and the gills.
Eyes and gills. Good to know. Yep. Thank you.
I knew you. In case of a shark attack, you should know that.
Okay. Did you guys ever see the movie The Beach where Leonardo DiCaprio has a shark attacking him and he has a little knife in his a wooden knife in his pocket and he stabs it?
Did it work?
Yeah, he killed the shark.
Well, if you have a knife on you.
He could do anything. Yeah.
I think the scenario didn't include a knife when I was thinking of it. Also, apparently, another thing you shouldn't do is suck out the poison when a snake bites you.
You're destroying all of these.
That's kind of something that's yeah.
I read this all
think
today.
That most people know that. Right?
Well, I didn't. I thought, you know.
You would want to suck out the
poison.
My
husband gets bitten by a snake. I would totally suck out the poison. And apparently I would.
You would not
I would
do that.
Die. Yeah,
yeah. You would not do that.
I probably would.
Really?
All right, so.
Yeah, but you know it's not all going to get out. And then you're going to be contaminated
die
as
too.
Well.
Yeah.
Well, no, because it goes in the digestive
like
system.
You know,
poison doesn't work when it goes through the digestive system.
Oh, okay.
Unless you have like a cut in your mouth. Anyway,
your
I have no idea.
More romantic. We'd both die.
We are spreading misinformation. We're gonna kill children with this information. So we should probably end. What's your biggest fear? What do you hate in the world?
I don't like fish either. I was telling you earlier, not sharks, all fish. I don't know where it came from.
Do you eat fish?
I eat them. Well, I have no problem eating them. It's like aquariums. So I have maybe it was also from watching Jaws. I don't know what it was, but when I'm in the water and I can't see my feet, I immediately think there are large fish down there that are going to bite me or eat my legs or something like that. So it's really big fish that I can't see that I really don't like. And aquariums. So this is what I think is really interesting about fear is that, you know, there are physiological responses that go along with it, and it's how you tag those. So I can go to aquariums, and I feel, it sounds dirty to say I feel aroused. I feel like my heart rate goes up.
Well, there's some kind of excitement.
I feel some kind of, you know, my heart rate goes up when I see the fish, but I'm not scared because I know that I'm in a safe environment. But if I'm in the ocean and I can't see my feet, I'm scared. So again, if you were to ask me whether I was afraid of snakes, the answer would be it depends. Like, am I afraid of a snake in the reptile house in the zoo? No. Am I afraid of bears in the zoo? No. But once I went to a wedding and I rented this house and there was a sign that said, don't leave food out because bears would come. And I did not go out on that beautiful deck all weekend because to me, that's terrifying.
When you're in the Catskills, you're more afraid of bears than when you go to like the Bronx Zoo.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So context really matters.
Which is such a great point. You have a blog called The Baby Scientist.
Yes, I do.
Is your goal to get moms into science? Is that what's going on here?
So that's a good question. So recently I became a mom. So before I became a mom.
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. I don't know if you want to congratulate me or say that you're sorry for my loss of time.
I mean, maybe both. I don't know.
Sleep. But
no, more so.
No, it's great. But I, not that I didn't care about moms before I became a mom. It's just that how science is translated to parents and moms in particular became an important issue for me once I became a mom. And I, and what I saw is that science is translated pretty badly for parents. And, most of it is really, you know, it's quite negative and people, you know, freak out about all of these things about development. Oh, how much TV should I watch? And oh, this study came out and oh my God, now I can't swaddle my baby because he's going to die of SIDS.
And every kid has autism.
And every kid has autism. And I just
That's
feel, I feel, you know, people ask me, what has developmental psychology done for me in terms of parenting? You know, being an expert in developmental psychology, does that make you a really anxious parent? And actually it makes me, I think, a really laid back parent because I know that a lot of these things, you know, that people worry about aren't that big of a deal. I mean, there are things that really mess up kids, but they tend to be maltreatment, poverty, neglect. These are the things that really big things, you know, watching Sesame Street doesn't really like register on my radar of things that you should be worried about. There was a study that came out maybe 6 months ago suggesting it was like the headline was like, don't swaddle your kids. Increased risk of SIDS. And it's just like, if you're a parent and you don't know about science, what you're going to do is stop swaddling your kids and probably have a lot of sleepless nights because your kids are not going to, your babies aren't going to sleep very well. And really the research just suggests that, you know, when you swaddle a baby tightly, once they can turn themselves over, you should stop doing it. And we already knew this. This is not shocking. You know, most swaddles that you buy will say you have to stop doing this once kids can turn themselves over. And that's because, you know, they're swaddled, they're flipping themselves over and they're face planting on the bed and they can't move around anymore. So it's not that swaddling leads to SIDS. It's the logic behind it is really reasonable where once they start turning themselves over, you need to stop because they need to be able to turn themselves back. And I just, now that I'm a mom and I have friends that are moms and I see their reactions to this sort of, this research, I just feel an obligation to try to translate it for them as best as I can. And I really enjoy it. I really like talking to moms. And as a mom, you know, I understand what the anxiety, talking about fear and anxiety. I have never experienced fear and anxiety like I do now that I'm a parent. And I understand how these headlines, like, I understand the anti-vax movement now more than I ever did. I am not an anti-vaxxer. I think it's very dangerous to not vaccinate your kids. But these moms...
Empathy for these...
Well, they think that what they're doing is best for their children. They really think that not vaccinating is protecting their babies. And I'm very sympathetic to wanting to protect children. So, you know, my goal with my blog is to translate research in a very practical and non-alarmist way so that, you know, parents can kind of chill out a bit about certain issues. One of my recent posts was just on why it's okay to have a dog, you know, what the benefits to dogs might be for children. And you know, it's practical. You shouldn't let your children eat dog food. I mean, why? Because dog food is not good for them and it might carry salmonella, but
it's
otherwise.
It's good for their immune system.
Well, it could be. And the dog, there was a recent study.
Not the dog food, being around dogs.
Being around dogs that, you know, kids that are around dogs or cats at home are less likely to have animal allergies than kids that are not around dogs. So.
It's good for, I feel like it's good for moms to hear this from scientist moms.
Yeah.
Because there's so much out there that, as you were just describing, I mean, that is...
Well, it's not just that I like doing it. I feel something of a responsibility to do it because there are few of us that are developmental psychologists that know about development and that can actually look at this research and translate it in a way that would be relevant to parents. So that's why I write the blog.
What's the name of the blog?
The Baby Scientist. It's thebabyscientist.com. If you're a mom and you like science, you should read it.
So she's communicating to the public in a variety of ways, including this one. It's fantastic. You're obviously good at communicating your science.
Hopefully.
Yeah. No, this has been a very freewheeling and fun conversation, I think.
Totally. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Delta Cast.
Yeah.
And thanks for plugging my blog. That was an unexpected
bonus.
I
would be afraid if I didn't.
We wouldn't want that.
Delta Cast is the official podcast of the Delta Center at the University of Iowa and is co-produced by Eric Jackson, Mark Blumberg, and Jessica Hall. The Delta Center is supported by the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, the College of Education, the Office of the Vice President for Research, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Obermann Center. All of the music you heard during today's podcast was written by my good friend Josh Kaufman. Thank you, Josh. You can learn more about the Delta Center by going to www.deltacenter.uiowa.edu, and you can also follow us on Facebook.